Each weekday at this time, the Washington Post presents William Gold with a preview of tomorrow morning's editions. And now, direct from the Post, here's Bill.
Good evening, friends. This is one of those nights on which I think we can best tell the story of the news in terms of people, looking behind the scenes at the human beings who are making the news. Let's start back on the sports page with the kind of story that you very seldom find on sports pages. This one appears in Shirley Povich's column in tomorrow morning's Washington Post. And just in case you haven't been following this particular case, I'll give you a quick fill-in on the background. When a veteran comes back from service, the Selective Service Law says that he's got a right to his old job back again for at least a year. But the big league baseball clubs made a rule of their own because player contracts specify that the club can fire an employee on 10 days' notice. This spring, Bruce Campbell came back to the Nats after missing three seasons because of the war. Before spring training was over, the Nats had fired him. Clark Griffith tried to help Campbell get a good job with a minor league team, but that didn't work out either. Campbell was dropped by the minor league team, too, and now he's suing the Nats for 1 year's pay. Mr. Griffith thinks he did as much as he could have done for Campbell, and Campbell thinks he has a year's pay coming because of that selective service law. So that's the background. Tomorrow morning, Shirley Povich is printing a letter he received commenting on the case. The correspondent says that there are a few things that ought to be made public, and since Campbell won't make them public, the letter writer will. The letter describes Campbell's joining the Army in 1942 amid the usual publicity which, in those early days, attended the induction of a big leaguer. Bruce was an established star, so he was sent to Waco, Texas, to give physical education instruction to officers. He worked 3 hours a day, and the rest of the time he was free to play baseball. Another big leaguer was at the same station, and great plans were being made for a super-duper Army baseball team. But Bruce Campbell said, "Not for me. I joined the Army to help win the war, not to play baseball." And so he requested transfer to a field where he could become an aerial engineer and fly as part of a bomber crew. His commanding officer didn't like the idea of breaking up that wonderful ball club. And in retaliation, Campbell was transferred to the airfield at Liberal, Kansas, which this letter writer describes, and I quote, as the hell hole to end all hell holes. But at Liberal Field, Campbell got what he wanted, a chance to do a war job. He took a ship which had previously been considered a death trap and made it into a real airplane. He got up at 2 o'clock in the morning to prepare his ship, flew with the pilot and crew when they took off on a mission, and then stayed behind when they landed to service the ship for the next trip. With careful detail, the letter writer sketches in the long hours and the danger of the assignment. He tells of frequent crashes and of the many men who were killed in this work. And he tells, too, of Bruce Campbell's steadfast refusal to play ball, even with the pickup teams around the field. He just wasn't in the Army for a soft job or ball playing. Then the letter concludes with an eloquent paragraph that says, Bruce Campbell was a big league aerial engineer, and mistakes in that league are a little bit different than in baseball. If you make mistakes in combat aircraft, you don't get sent down to the minors. You wind up in a funeral procession. So if Bruce Campbell isn't as good a ball player today as he was when he entered the service, maybe those 748 hours of flying time are the reason. Or maybe he just left something 30,000 feet up in the air, where it's 30 below, and every man's life depends on the engineer's batting average. Maybe you'd like to know who this letter writer is, why he's so all-fired interested in Bruce Campbell, and how he knows so much about him. Well, I'll tell you. He's just the pilot who flew that bomber that Campbell served as engineer. So there's one human being whose own personal story has become a small part of what we call the day's news report. Maybe one man's job isn't so terribly important in these critical days, and then again, maybe it's very important after all. Bruce Campbell spent 3 years fighting for something. Maybe it's important to all of us that he should come home to a square shake. Well, so much for one of our human beings. Let's have a look at four others who wanted a square shake. Let's see how they made out. Down in Monroe, Georgia, a Negro named Roger Malcolm was in jail, charged with stabbing a white man. The white man's in a hospital now, recovering from the wound. Bail for Malcolm was set at $600, and a wealthy Georgia farmer drove into town, put up the bail money, and started to take Malcolm out to his farm. Also in the car with them were the Negro's wife, another Negro, and his wife. But on the way out to the farmer's place, the party was ambushed, and the two male Negroes were taken from the car. When one of the wives recognized a member of the ambush party, the women were taken, too. A man with a shotgun asked the farmer, "Do you recognize anybody here?" And the farmer said no. So the massacre proceeded without him. The four Negroes were lined up. The leader of the mob ordered his men to fire, and the four bodies fell to the ground. A second volley was ordered, and then a third. The four victims were so badly riddled that they were hardly recognizable. Then the farmer was told to get in his car and get going. The party was over. One of those victims died because he'd been charged with stabbing a white man. His friend died because he just happened to be there. The women died because one of them recognized a member of that lynch mob. Four more human beings whose stories are part of the news report that comes banging in over the teletypes. And I guess we can again ask the same questions that were suggested by that story about Bruce Campbell. How important are four ordinary folks we never heard of before? Is this another story that we read and toss aside? Or is a lynching pretty important to all of us? There used to be a fellow named Hitler over in Germany who thought he was above the law, too. He was a pretty high flyer in his day, and he attracted a mob of roughnecks around him who didn't stop at lynching people four at a time. Their technique was on a grander scale. They wanted to wipe out an entire race, and almost did it. And they even thought they could murder entire nations. And what's left of Poland today will bear witness to how close they came to succeeding. They say Hitler killed himself when he failed. The 22 of his mob weren't so lucky. For months, they've been sitting in a Nuremberg courtroom, listening to the damning evidence pile up against them. And today, as their trial neared its end, they heard Justice Robert H. Jackson demand the death penalty for all of them as conspirators who had banded together to plan a war of aggression. They heard Jackson say, "Adolf Hitler's acts are their acts. His guilt is the guilt of the whole dock and every man in it." And there they sat, 22 more human beings whose story is the story of the news. Goering, von Ribbentrop, Hess, Keitel, Stryker, we used to tremble at those names, Rosenberg, von Papen, the infamous Seyss Inquart, and all the rest of Hitler's lynch mob. They're all human beings, I suppose, and if we could ever find out precisely what got them that way, maybe we could prevent others from imitating them, and maybe we could live in peace with one another. You know, securing the peace is not going to be an easy job. We're not only still at loggerheads with Russia, but apparently we've now arrived at a new area of disagreement, as if we needed another one. The United States this evening charged the Russians with creating economic chaos in Hungary, contrary to Premier Stalin's promises at Yalta. Our State Department ordered Ambassador Beadle Smith to deliver a letter to the Kremlin protesting Russian removal of food supplies and industrial materials from Hungary and rejecting Russian claims that she was not interfering with the Hungarians. In effect, the letter said to Stalin, "Now this has gone too far, and you'd better stop it." Whether by chance or design, the new disagreement flares into the open at just the moment when Secretary of State Burns is packing his bags to go to Paris for that peace conference. And the whole world knows that at Paris, the big question will be whether Russia and the United States will be able to agree with each other. If they do, a lasting peace should emerge from that conference. But if they don't, well, I'd rather not think about that possibility. I think I'd rather concentrate instead on the good humor and the common sense of the man who's going to represent us in Paris. Because in shrewd little Jimmy Burns rest our hopes for understanding and international cooperation. We're all going to have a chance to say goodbye and Godspeed to Jimmy tomorrow morning. He'll leave the White House at 11:30 in an open car with President Truman at his side and a good many other high officials following in other cars. They'll motor over a predetermined route out to National Airport. Tomorrow morning's Post is going to carry a diagram of that route, and the motorcade is going to follow along the path of the arrows in the little diagram, and you'll know just exactly where you can stand in order to see them. And then you'll also find a summary of the program that's scheduled for out at the airport. Government workers are going to be excused at 11 tomorrow morning so that they can either watch from downtown vantage points or come out to the airport where there are going to be loudspeakers set up so that everybody can hear what's going on. And then the president and all the rest of us are going to say goodbye to Jimmy and to wish him a very successful mission. You know, when Bruce Campbell was doing his job as an aerial engineer, the difference between success and failure was the difference between life and death. And strangely enough, I think Jimmy Burns is going to have pretty much the same kind of job in Paris. So I guess if you want to reduce any news story to its essentials, you've got to think in terms of the human equation. Take that OPA story, for example. The headlines tonight say that the reborn Office of Price Administration sent out new orders by the dozen, permitting price increases on such varied items as shoes and coal and chinaware and a lot of others. And then it sent out other orders removing all price ceilings from another varied list of items, including industrial machinery, if you want to buy any, medicine droppers, floor mats, and fruit jar rings. The government economists are already translating that kind of news into millions and billions for us to tell us just how much it's going to mean to the nation as a whole. But I think the only way to really understand the story is to walk into a store and try to buy something. New cars, for example, are going up about $100 for the low-priced models and more on the expensive ones. And after you get one, or while you're still driving the old one, you'll probably be paying more for gasoline and all the other upkeep items. So the question in the president's mind when he signed the bill was this: is this new law going to hold the cost of living down enough to permit the people to make both ends meet? Or will it bring us to the verge of economic disaster? When we get the answer to that question, I think it'll come in terms of people. People who either can or can't stretch the family paycheck to cover living expenses. And now let's talk about some other people. For one, the weatherman, who apparently isn't such a bad guy after all. For tomorrow, he's going to give us clear, dry weather and moderate temperatures, bless him. Another sterling character is Mickey Hefner of the Nats, who pitched our boys to a 5-4 victory over the Indians tonight. And Mickey got some help from Cease Travis, who came in as a ninth-inning pinch hitter to drive in the winning tally. Looks like Cease wants his job back. In the National League, the Brooklyn Dodgers lost while the Cardinals were idle, and so that trims the Brooklyn lead to one game. And now, before I go, here's one last story with a human interest twist to it. Most of you are familiar with the byline of Robert Tate Allen, I'm sure. Robert Tate Allen is the chap who handles the religious news on the Post. Every Saturday, Deacon Allen's column, News and Views, is read by thousands because he's so intensely interested in his work that the column is invariably filled with very readable religious news. But the other day, Allen decided that he was keeping his nose to the grindstone too constantly, and he ought to go to the movies and get away from religious subjects for a while. So he chose William S. Hart in a good, old-fashioned, rip-snorting Western. And you can imagine his dismay when religion followed him even there. The heroine was in the clutches of the villain up in the church tower, and William S. Hart, lying injured at the foot of the tower, rescued her by remote control by taking careful aim and bouncing a bullet, billiard fashion, off the old church bell. Allen's moral to the story is that even at a cowboy picture, you can't escape the religious angle. But I think my conclusion is that even with all this important news that's breaking these days, this program can't escape Robert Tate Allen. Good night.
Good night, Bill, and listen again tomorrow night at this same time for William Gold and Post Preview. For home delivery of the Washington Post, call National 4200. This is Washington's home station.